Football on the Sports Social Podcast Network is brought to you by BetVictor in-play betting. Watch the action, predict the action, and make your best bet with the latest odds on over 1,000 daily events. 18 plus BeGambleAware.org.
Newcastle score 8. Hello and welcome to episode 8 of this season's Real Football Cast. As always, I'm your host Dan Tracy, and in the next 60 minutes, we'll be dissecting all the hot topics in football. As per usual, we'll be discussing what's been going on in the Premier League over the past few days, while in addition to that, there are also some off-pitch activities that have caught our eye and that will be getting our attention in the next hour. It's been another incredible week of football, and this week, it's two up top. That means leading the line around the captain's armband is Carl. So Carl, how have you been since we last spoke?
Yeah, really good, thanks, Dan. You know, North London derby weekend and everything, so can't moan too much. But looking forward to discussing what was an action-packed Premier League weekend with goals and controversial decisions, Dan.
It certainly was. You're in the right place for all that kind of chat. You're also going to be joined by Fulham fan Matthew. Matthew, how are things with you, my friend? Hope all is well.
Yep, all's good on my end, especially after another weekend of Fulham not managing to lose.
Well, I think we're going to get to that at the very end of the show, if we do at all, because it wasn't a great game, but I promise we'll get some chat if we've got time. But anyway, I best see the social media...
Totally understood. If we don't talk about it, we'll totally fine.
Right, OK. At least we're clear on that front. But anyway, let's do the social media bits, otherwise we'll be talking into the abyss once more. First, if you want to get in touch with me, you can. That's on Twitter, at DanTracy1983. Also, the podcast has its own account, which is at Real Football Pod. And if you want to become a shareholder, all you need to do is follow and join our very elite members club. Talking of clubs, I'm delighted to announce we're now part of the UK's first ever sports podcast network, that being Sports Social. So check out the URL and all the links posted throughout the week on the Real Football Pod account. You can find me via iTunes by searching for Real Football Cast. If you use that platform, don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss a single episode. And if you like us, leave a review so we move up the league table. Also, the easiest way to find all the links is by going to linktree.com/realfootballcast. Put a dot between the R and the E. You get 10 podcast platforms to choose from. It's never been easier to listen to this show. Right then, it's time to go live. Where should we go first? Let's go to Bramall Lane first, as Newcastle put a staggering 8 goals past Sheffield United and Cole. We've highlighted that the promoted teams are going to be in trouble. We perhaps didn't account for this much trouble.
Yeah, I'm actually really worried then for the three sides that come up last season, because, you know, I think in our group chat that we had, I think Matthew kind of made a really good comment this weekend where we actually said, you know, I thought Luton could potentially beat Derby's previous lowest points total. But as Matthew rightly said, I think we could be in danger of having at least two of those sides potentially look at beating that lowest points record this season. And I think we really are seeing, for the first time ever, I think, a massive quality gap and gulf between the three sides that have been promoted this year and the sides that were remaining in the Premier League. And the worry from what I've already seen so far from the three promoted sides this season is that the rest of the league can just be thinking, well, actually, we're not going to be as poor as these three sides. So ultimately, we're probably going to be safe from relegation just by default, because you really can't see where these sides are going to be picking up too many points, to be honest. And we've normally at least had one or two of those promoted sides that come up and show that they can kind of handle life in the Premier League. But this year, I think we really are looking at the three sides where anyone else down there just thinks we can't be worse than these three, so we'll be fine this season. And chances are we won't be going down. So really worrying, and especially that result for Sheffield United, because I don't see how they pick themselves up off the floor after that.
Well, Matthew, in terms of the scoreline, that's obviously the headline. But when you look at the way Sheffield United played at Bramall Lane on Sunday, the overall level of performance has got to be a serious worry.
Yeah, it is. I mean, you can understand that, you know, they've been competitive in games this season. Like, they gave Manchester City a hell of a go, and probably would have been, were fortunate to only lose by 2-1 if Haaland had had a better game. But with a team like Newcastle coming in, that's a sort of exposed that, yeah, if you are not having a good day, that there are teams in the league that can know, they can punish you, and Newcastle are certainly one of those teams.
Well, Cole, if you're Sheffield United and the board, do you look at that result and think, do you know what, it might be time to change things already in terms of the manager? Let's look at Scott Parker last season, shipped 9 goals to Liverpool, gone the following week. So Paul Heckingbottom still in charge as we speak. Do you reckon he gets the weekend, or do you reckon they might change it around?
Yeah, I'm not sure. I guess the thing is, you know, there was worrying signs from him as a manager in the summer, wasn't it, when he was saying that the club wasn't ready and the club was nowhere near at the quality to kind of compete at this level. And then you've seen some of the performances from them so far this season, and that one at the weekend, I think, was the most worrying one of all. I reckon he probably gets at least a couple more weeks, because the season is still early, you know, it is still early days. But I think if in the next two performances they haven't shown a vast improvement, and to be honest, if next weekend they was to get hammered 4 or 5 again, then I would be very surprised if Sheffield United bald and not looking and thinking, right, what can we do here? Can we make a change that might at least change the trajectory that the club's going in at the moment? So he probably is pretty close to the old chopping board, I should imagine.
Well, Matthew, there's even been talk of Chris Wilder returning to the post at Bramall Lane. So firstly, there's always that adage of never go back. I'm not sure that actually is a good move, but whoever this name could be that's floating around, is that making life even harder for Heckingbottom at the moment?
Yeah, I think that's sort of something we have to consider when you're talking about, is Paul Heckingbottom for the chop? If there's already rumours of someone coming in to take over, that sort of adds more, you know, adds more fuel to the fire, as it were. Whether or not it's Chris Wilder is the best choice, I don't know. I mean, when it comes to, I think we've sort of talked about this before, when it comes to never go back, it's usually about a player coming back, because they can never, because they're always a couple of years older, they're probably past their peak, so they can't really perform the same way that they were able to, you know, 5 years earlier or something. You know, I think of Dempsey when he came back to Fulham after his spell away. Whereas a manager, I think it's slightly different, as David Moyes has proved at West Ham United. But as you say, if there are rumours, again, how true they are is a different matter. But if there are rumours floating around, then I can understand why Paul Heckingbottom might be thinking, oh yeah, it's just looking over his shoulder a little bit more nervously now.
Now, Cole, obviously it's all immaterial now, as Newcastle put 8 goals past Sheffield United. But with that being said, do you think Anthony Gordon should have had a penalty in the first half? I think that looked far more Stonewall than some of the others that we'll talk about this weekend.
Yeah, I do, Dan. And, you know, I think this goes back to the one we saw last weekend with James Maddison against Sheffield United. And I think they got away with one there. And I think, again, this weekend, they've managed to get away with one. Because, you know, I'm benchmarking penalties now around the penalty that was given against us in the first game of the season at Brentford. Where, you know, Heung-min Son makes the tackle in the box, and you know, ultimately it wasn't the strongest contact, but you know, ultimately they were saying, but there was contact on the player. So you sit there then and say, well, if that's the standard of penalty you're going to give, when we see those now, well, I expect penalties to be given. And I think we've seen two now, you know, last week the one with Maddison where the guy goes through the back of him, and this week, you know, Gordon turns the defender. And although we're not talking about scything down at all, the guy does touch and kick Gordon's ankle. So he goes down. I would assume that on looking on that again on a replay, given what we've seen, given that the VAR official should be saying, we need to look at this. I think there is actually a foul there and a penalty should be awarded. So they definitely got lucky in that instance, that's for sure.
Yeah, it's such a strange one, because as you say, there's a perfect benchmark already that we've seen in week one. You sort of think to yourself, if the referee hasn't spotted it, how have VAR also not spotted it themselves? I know contact doesn't automatically equal a penalty, but surely there was enough contact there. Like, the threshold must have been crossed for it to be a spot kick. I don't understand that one. So I think that's a bad refereeing decision in the main. But Matthew, handballs are going to be a central theme to this week's discussion. Once again, we'll focus on Anthony Gordon and the opening goal on Sunday. If he scores that goal with the same hand motion that we saw, that goal's chalked off because of handball. So do you think the law should be, in effect, scrubbing it off because it's still a handball anyway?
Yeah, I think that's very much the law. No, the law is the problem in that situation. You can't blame Anthony Gordon.
No.
Someone explained to me on Twitter, because I think it was after, you know, the impeccable Dale Johnson explained it on Twitter that, you know, if Anthony Gordon had scored, you know, you can only be penalised for a handball if it's in the direct act and if it was the person who scored the goal that did it. You know, so if Anthony Gordon had shot and scored there, then it would have been handball. But seeing as he was the assist provider rather than the handball law has sort of gone through a load of changes in the past couple of years with the advent of VAR. That is one of the more confusing aspects of it, that a player could, again, accidental, deliberate, or whatever, he can commit the foul so long as he then doesn't score the goal. So it's a confusing one, and one that I think you would hope at least the authorities look at and, you know, look to change when they get the chance, probably at the end of the season.
Yeah, it feels like a loophole that needs closing. I mean, you know, when you look at handballs and even what we've seen this weekend, that's probably the most clear-cut example of a handball which should have led to a free kick to Sheffield United. But because he doesn't score the goal stands. It's kind of weird, really, and I just don't really understand how that's fair, considering the penalisation we've seen from two other defenders in the week, which we're going to get to in just a moment. But it just seems like how they got away with that. Right, let's go to the North London derby. And Cole, the 2-2 draw at the end of 90 frenetic minutes. Would you say it was a case of Arsenal not quite doing enough to win and Tottenham not deserving to lose at the Emirates?
Yeah, I think maybe you could say that. I think it just was a, you know, one of those really good, hectic North London derbies. Whereas we've always said, you know, form can kind of go out the window and players, you know, lots of new players playing their first London derby, so you don't know how they're going to react in that sort of atmosphere. But I just thought it was a really good game. And overall, I don't think any team probably did enough to say that they should have won that game. And I think, you know, yeah, if you look back, a 2-2 draw, which I would have bitten your hand off before the game, I think was a fair result, because both teams might look back on opportunities squandered and opportunities where they feel they might have been able to win that game. So I think a draw was a fair result.
Yeah, I'd agree on that one. Matthew, would you agree with Mikel Arteta's comments about 2 points dropped? I guess in the context of what is now the early title race and City's perfect start themselves, does he have a fair point?
I think there is, because I think if you look at what Arsenal have started to do and where they've started to position themselves in amongst the, you know, the top part of the Premier League, and while Spurs are, you know, have situated themselves in the top four, they're still very much going through changes, you know, getting used to Harry Kane and everything, and moving up from, you know, where they were last season. Arteta clearly thinks that they are the better side and the bigger side, and I would tend to agree. So if you are Arsenal, you're thinking if you go 1-0 up and then you go 2-1 up against a Spurs side, and you are a team that is looking to, you know, challenge for the title, that is a game you should be closing out. So even though it was a very evenly fought game, to say 2 points drop, I think, is a very fair assessment.
Okay, then, Cole, the way Tottenham played was certainly easy on the eye, but there were a few heart-in-mouth moments, especially in the first half. None more so than when James Maddison was pickpocketed by Gabriel Jesus. So the ball opens up to the Brazilian. He lacks composure in the finish to make it 2-2. I mean, if he just strokes it either side, that's a goal. Do you reckon that's the big miss from an Arsenal perspective?
I think so, yeah. I mean, that would probably have been crucial, because I think at that point, if he puts that away and it's 2-0, I think there is a chance that Arsenal potentially go and take that game away from us more than they did at 1-0. Because I think then, you know, heads really drop, don't they? You know, conceding a goal in that manner is bad enough. At 2-0, I think Arsenal, I think Spurs' heads might have dropped a little bit more. Arsenal would have, you know, been in that momentum where, right, we're really on top in this game. So I think, yeah, you would look back on that and say it was a glorious opportunity to make it 2-0 and probably win the game. So, yeah, massive opportunity missed. But that is the sort of opportunity, I'm afraid, that Jesus just is capable of doing, isn't he?
Yeah.
You know, he's not as ruthless as he probably, you know, Arsenal need him to be. And ultimately, I think that was one of the reasons why City weren't too worried about letting him go. Because, yes, on his day, he can be great, but he can also cost you games by missing, you know, easy opportunities like that one.
Now, Matthew, obviously, I've just referenced the heart-in-mouth moments. At that moment that happens where Gabriel Jesus misses, if you're a manager, you'd be very tempted to say, right, this isn't working, let's change it up, let's be a bit more pragmatic and just get to half-time, do nothing silly. Does Ange Postecoglou have to be commended for ignoring all of that and saying, no, we're going to keep playing as we do, and then eventually they got further up the pitch?
I think Ange Postecoglou has sort of positioned himself as it is, you know, it's my way or hard way or the highway, and his attitude has sort of come across as, you know, my methods work. You know, you saw what happened at Celtic and throughout my managerial career. This is, you know, this is going to work. I'm not going to let one moment sort of, you know, ruin everything and try and break up the team cohesion that has, you know, that has worked so far this season. So I do commend it for, you know, one mistake shouldn't really change your whole outlook. I mean, if maybe he'd scored, then maybe he may have considered something else. But the fact they managed to get away with it probably changed that a bit.
Now, Carl, the most contentious part of the day was Christian Romero's penalty that he gave away in the second half. Not a great day for him, it must be said. I mean, he didn't play too badly, but he was in the war zone in terms of the own goal and then the penalty award. Now, when you consider that the Argentine puts a knee to the floor first, can you then say that the hand is raised thereafter? Because surely his shape as the body and the silhouette and all that is still natural. What do you make of that?
Yeah, I honestly didn't have, I suppose, an issue with the penalty being given, because I think if that was at the other end, I also would be wanting a penalty to be given for us. I think the problem you had with this one was, although his body was still in a natural position, I think when the ball hits the arm where it is, I think that ball was heading into the net. So I do think that has stopped a goal scoring opportunity for Arsenal. So I have some sympathy as to why that was given, and probably can understand VAR saying, well, listen, if that doesn't hit his arm, that's going in. So I think we do need to give a penalty in that instance. And like I say, if that was at the other end, I would have been screaming for a penalty. And had it not been given, although I'd be saying, well, yes, he's not making an exaggerated move with the arm, but if the ball doesn't hit the arm, it's going in, and we're suddenly we're in front and leading the game. So I'm not too aggrieved with the penalty decision, to be honest, but it's one of them you could say is harsh from how close the ball's hit at him. He's not put his arm up in an unnatural position, but I understand that one.
Okay then, Matthew, let's build on that then. Let's play a bit of devil's advocate, because if Carl's saying that it's stopping a goal-scoring opportunity, which you can see it probably is, by the letter of the law, that's a red card. Now, what is the non-red card here? Is it the saving grace of the positioning? Is it the speed of the ball hitting the hand? You know, it's not clear and obvious, in my eyes anyway, but what do you reckon the referee's seeing to not give a red card here?
Yeah, I think that's sort of it. I mean, the fact that he was sent to go to VAR showed that there was some element of doubt in it. And, you know, maybe it was a case of, you know, they didn't want to have the was it the triple penalty or triple punishment or yes, whatever it is they wanted. And as you say, I did think it was a bit of a grey area with the handball, because was it outside of his natural body position, or was that impacted by the fact he was turning to block? So it's not as if he was, you know, spread eagled or did what, you know, often, you know, the Luis Suarez incident, then you could probably say, yeah, that's definitely a red card. But it's not a deliberate act to, you know, to block the ball with his hand. So I think in that instance, I think you could probably say, yeah, a penalty is justified. A red card probably would have been very, very harsh indeed.
OK, then, Carl, Spurs were level just 60 seconds later. And we spoke about Jesus's miss just a moment ago. Do you think Jorginho is going to have to carry some of this one? Because as soon as he got the ball, it's almost as if James Maddison could smell the fear that he had then around him.
Yeah, it was really interesting, wasn't it? Because when he received the ball, he had so much time just to get it out of his feet and look up and make a pass. I really don't understand why he ended up getting himself caught by Maddison the way he did. And ultimately, it is one of them that you can't forgive, can you? You're just like, what are you doing? We've just got ourselves in front and you're messing around. You know, even if he just put it back to the goalkeeper at that point, and, you know, you probably think Arsenal go on to win the game. So he has cost them the 3 points for that. But I guess, you know, all players can make mistakes, and he unfortunately just managed to make one in the worst possible area. And the ball fell probably to the best player we could hope it would fall for, who was calm, collected, and put himself and put the ball in the right position for Son just to get the equaliser. But one of those that I think you probably have sleepless nights over for at least a week or so if you're the player.
And Matthew, much has been made of Arsenal's over-celebrations and the theatrics behind it. Can they be guilty of overperforming when the Gunners got their second, or does this circle back to Jorginho's blunder?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, there is that always that element of that cliche that, you know, the most dangerous time to concede, or you're most likely to concede after you've scored a goal. And I think, as you say, the emotion of the situation probably just caused them to take their eye off the ball, just that little bit. You know, would they have been the same if they just scored that penalty against Wolves, say, or Sheffield United? The fact there was a North London derby and the fans are sort of G'ing them on to, you know, to the extra extent probably did cause them just to take their eye off the ball just that little bit.
And Carl, in terms of Saka, his celebration, the darts and all of that, do you reckon that is an in-joke between the two of them, or is that a show of disrespect?
No, I think James Maddison did come out, didn't he, and say that, you know, while they were on England duty, they were having a bit of banter between them and everything like that. So I guess, you know, there's been something go on between them, and Saka may have said to him, if I score in that North London derby, I'm going to do the old dart throw in to the camera. But, you know, that's what it is, isn't it? You know, I don't mind seeing some of that. And hopefully, with a little bit of luck, that it could be the sort of thing that would spur some of the players on to go, oh, right, you wanna be going and doing that, do you? I'll show you in a minute. And thankfully, James Maddison was able to, at the end of the game, be able to say, well, listen, I think we probably come out on top with that. So he's done it, but it's kind of backfired on him a little bit because they haven't got the win.
Well, Matthew, do you reckon it did backfire? Because obviously, Saka scores twice, does that double celebration. Then Maddison plays a part in both Spurs' goals, and then he's celebrating himself. So do you reckon that's, you know, just the flow of the game, or that is Maddison giving it an extra percentage to say, look, Saka, it's not all about you?
I think that's just the flow of the game. I think it just happens to be a coincidence. You know, there's some friendly rivalry going on. You can imagine, say, with the England setup, they've probably done it a couple of times for each other. It's just I wouldn't read anything too much into it personally.
Okay, let's stay in London now, because it's going from bad to worse for Chelsea right now. One win all season, and Cole, all of a sudden people are wondering whether Pochettino can make it to November and his anticipated return to Spurs.
Yeah. You know, he's maybe performing an inside job at the moment, then, you know? But no, it's hard to put your finger on what's going wrong at Chelsea, isn't it? And why they're looking as poor as they are at the moment. You know, I think I said to yourself when Poch got that job, and I've said to some Chelsea friends, in his first season at Spurs, we were very hit and miss at times, you know, and there was a point where I think it was the result at Aston Villa with a Kane deflected free kick that kind of ended up turning the season around, and then we seemed to get going from that point. But I think his early tenure at Spurs, we were, you know, it wasn't the sort of like, oh, this is the football we want to see. There were times there where we were scratching our head, and I think he's just got to kind of get himself in, get his methods across to that squad. And I think probably, you know, the lack of firepower isn't helping him, you know, the lack of that real goal scorer, and maybe the lack of not really knowing his best team and who does he trust yet and who doesn't he trust. So I think he will get it right. I think he'll be given time. I don't think he's going to be the manager that gets the boot, because if you look at the way Chelsea have gone through managers since Todd Bowley has taken over, I think, again, sacking another manager probably isn't the right move at this point. They just need to stick with it and kind of make sure they've got their blueprint of where they think they're going to go and how they're going to get there. But right now, there is a lot of pressure on them, because this isn't where Chelsea expect to see themselves.
Now, Matthew, Poch may last until November, but if you were Ben Chilwell, you may look to be off in January, because he was made vice-captain just recently, only a few weeks ago. He can't get near the starting 11 all of a sudden. So is something not adding up, in your opinion?
Yeah, I think there is, because if you look at what Chelsea's options are, you know, they've gone through all their spending in the summer, but you look at the state of their squad, and there are still a lot of holes still to be filled. And the fact that Ben Chilwell, you know, someone who... you'll have to remind me, I do not care about the England team. Is he England starting left back these days, or is it still Luke Shaw?
It's Luke Shaw.
But anyway, he's in contention to be the starting left back. If he wants to be, you know, with the Euros coming up and everything like that, he's probably going to want to have a say and a decent chance to make it in the Euro squad rather. So if he's not if he's not a regular part of the Chelsea plan, then certainly you could certainly understand why he'd want to make a move with his international career in jeopardy.
Now, Carl, something certainly isn't adding up when it comes to Chelsea's attack. Now, if you're looking for positives, there haven't been many in the last couple of weeks. I think the only one you can say is they've created loads of chances. They're just lacking killer instinct in the past 2 weeks. So how is that something they address? Because they obviously can't buy anyone else till January. They've got so many players, whether they're good enough quality. I mean, they've even got Armando Broja back and ready to be fit again and ready to play. So he might be another option. And Nkunku can't get closer to their starting 11 due to injury at the moment. So is it a case of just being patient? I know Poch was sort of saying, getting that Lemons reference in the week, maybe buying himself some time. So how does it get resolved?
Well, I think they were unlucky with the injury to Nkudu, weren't they, in the summer, in the pre-season, because I think he was going to be their main front man this season. So that was an unfortunate injury. And obviously, they'll need to see how they start playing when he comes back and if he's a player that can suddenly hit the ground running and start scoring goals. I think one of the issues they have is, and it probably goes for more than just the striker position, is when you're bringing in young players, they can be hit and miss. And I think we're seeing that, you know, when you look at the guy Jackson up front, he can have moments where he looks brilliant, but then he can have moments where he looks like a bit of a, you know, a Sunday morning footballer. And again, he seems very wasteful. You know, he's not a real clinical finisher. So I think that probably is the one position that's really causing them the most harm because, you know, if they had, say, someone like Harry Kane up front right now, you think he'd be probably taking enough of those chances to either win them games or at least give them a strong foothold in some of those games and spread the confidence around a little bit. So where they are being quite wasteful, I think that's probably just having a knock-on effect and, you know, putting pressure on more of the players in other areas, feeling, well, listen, we've just squandered four or five chances here. We won't keep getting away with that. So I do feel they've been unlucky, but they might just have to wait now to see, you know, and hope they can get those injured players back and see if one of them hits the ground running and starts scoring the goals they need them to.
Now, at the same time, Matthew, we shouldn't overlook Ollie Watkins, who got the winning goal on Sunday. You'd have to say, from his own point of view, a goal that he needed as he's finally off the mark for the season.
Yeah, and I think going back to what I've said about Ben Chilwell is there are a lot of players who are looking to put themselves in position for an England call-up. You know, someone who scored the weekend, Dominic Solanke, is probably in that conversation as well. So the fact that Ollie Watkins is now managed to find it, obviously, straight after the international break, if he can, you know, continue, if he can you know, I'm not going to say run of form, but if he can turn this into a run of form, then he'll certainly position himself well, both, you know, both for Villa in their European campaigns and also for himself, if he wants to get himself back in the England squad.
Matthew, it's just popped into my head, actually. Will the England rattle be returning after Christmas, or have you got a new instrument or device for us?
I left the rattle back at the other side of the pond, so I have to find out. Maybe I'll get Henry to sort of get an English squad meow or something. I'll come up with something, don't worry.
Excellent. We've got plenty of time, but yes, let's work on that one. So let's also talk about Chelsea's going down to 10 men because they lost the game. They lost gusto to a red card in the second half. Carl, when you compare that tackle to Nketiah's tackle on Vicario in the North London derby, you once again wonder where that consistency's gone.
Yeah, and I think this is one of the biggest things that just frustrates fans, isn't it, Dan? Because, what I want to know and what I would like to ask the people in charge is, how can you have one set of officials look at a tackle like the Gusto one this weekend? And I sort of feel, you know, the red card is kind of harsh, but then you can also understand why it's been given because the studs are up and they're going into a player. But then I'd like to ask, but how are one set of officials looking at that and asking for a red card, and yet another set of officials can see the tackle that Nketiah makes on Vicario at the weekend and go, no, nothing wrong with that, play on. Because both, you know, the Nketiah one is 100 times worse than the Gusto one that sees him sent off. And, you know, just to add to this, Dan, not long ago, Dermot Gallagher was on Sky Sports trying to explain this decision, and he makes a joking comment saying, well, I think the reason Nketiah gets away with it is he doesn't really catch the player's leg, meaning the keeper's. And it's like, is he blind? He takes his ankle off at the joint. So how is that not catching the player's leg? So, yeah, these decisions are a joke. And I think that's the biggest issue. We need to make sure that if one set of officials are going to give something as a red card, that needs to be the standard across the board. You know, we can't be seeing this one set of officials don't give something, but another set a day later or in a different game give something, because that's what's killing VAR for people and turning fans away from it.
So, Matthew, I guess the question here is that, is VAR looking at the wrong things? In that, what Carl says is that you're going to have two different matches of football. You're going to have a different set of referees in either match. Now, because it's all down to opinion, those opinions could and probably will vary from time to time, as we saw on Sunday. So should VAR be focusing on not just goal line technology, but the ball going out of play? Should that be more in its remit? I don't know, like, you know, sort of corners, that kind of stuff. Should we be leaving opinion-based decisions to the officials on the pitch and not creating this extra layer of confusion? Should VAR be more technical?
I think that was sort of one of the discussions that I think many people have had when the VAR rollout started to begin, was, you know, should it really be for, like, because it started with, because the whole technology thing started with goals.
Yeah.
You know, was it over the line? Was it not? That's a definitive thing. There's no opinion on this. It's, we did it cross over the line. So they brought in the goal line technology and the cameras and everything. Then it's a case of, yeah, no, offsides. This, you know, offside isn't an opinion thing. It's right. Yes, his leg was in front of the last defender's leg, and so that is definitely offside. I think this is where the grey area comes in, but at the same time, we're all gonna say, but you know, where, you know, if you take away VAR and say no, VAR will not be overruling or interfering with, you know, red card decisions or bad tackles. Is you take that away, this point next season, we're going to have exactly the same tackles, and someone's going to say, oh, but why didn't VAR come back? Come back and change it. Why isn't there someone helping the referee when he's missed a blatant red card or something? So it is a bit of a quandary. Have we gone too far in order to change it? I honestly think we have.
Well, Carl, when you compare the offsides, for example, to the Champions League that we saw in the midweek, UEFA used that semi-automated offside that we saw in the World Cup, and it seems to be much, much better. So why are the Premier League hesitant not to bring that in themselves?
Yeah, I don't know, because I think that just causes them more problems than it does, doesn't it, Dan? You know, because with the whole drawing of the lines, you always get the argument, don't you, around, oh, what's the angle that's being looked at, and is it definitely the moment the ball is being played? But at least with the one that's being used in the Champions League, it kind of looks a little more like, well, yeah, actually, you can clearly see he is just offside, or that is, you know, that arm is just in front, or that foot is in front. So I do think they should just actually implement this technology. You know, the whole point is, if we're going to use the technology, that's used the most up to date and, you know, if you like, what's deemed better version of the technology that we've currently got. So yeah, I'm not really sure what they're delaying for, and I think ultimately they should just bite the bullet and kind of implement this as quick as possible.
Absolutely. Matthew, you also made a good point off podcast chat about Gusto's tackle and the fact that if you compared that to Robinson for Sheffield United, Robinson got a yellow, Gusto got a red. If you swap the two outcomes, give Gusto the booking, Robinson the red, I don't think anyone would complain, would they?
No, I think that's right. Just when you look at the, you know, the way that the whole thing, you know, the both tackles, you know, look at Robertson's. If you want to make the argument, even though he got the ball, if you want to make the argument of reckless, I think you can make the argument, and not many people would have complained. As opposed to what Gusto did. So, yeah, if you swap the outcomes, I don't think there would have been many complaints. It again just goes to the overarching point is, there just needs to be more consistency. I, you know, different referees would have had different levels of interpretation and stuff, but just the inconsistency is just a major problem that is, you know, it's just screaming out that it needs to be solved as soon as possible.
Now, there was no complaints for Liverpool on Sunday as they got the better of West Ham in the end at Anfield. Carl, have we, in general, or maybe just us, overlooked Jurgen Klopp's men somewhat? They're unbeaten this season, 5 league wins in a row now. Do they have all the components to mount a title charge?
I do think they do have the possibility of being up there and, you know, being a team that can run Man City as close. And I think with them and Arsenal, you'd probably say, from what we've seen so far, that would probably be my top three on what I've seen. So, yeah, I don't think we can write Liverpool off. I guess the ultimate test is how they can cope when they come up. You know, West Ham, I think, did really well at certain points in that game. I just wonder whether Liverpool have got enough in the squad and enough quality in case they pick up some injuries to be able to carry that on. You know, if Mo Salah goes down injured at some point, have they got enough consistent performers that will be able to get them over the line in certain games? And are they where they need to be defensively? West Ham didn't test them as well as they might have done. So I think that's probably where there's still question marks over Liverpool. But while they're doing what they're doing, then, yeah, you can't write them off, that's for sure.
Well, Matthew, let's quickly focus on how they played against West Ham. More, actually, let's focus on West Ham's chances in the first half. Mikel Antonio, probably guilty of a real bad miss. And you think if he scores that, that's a completely different game. Because I know Bowen made it 1-1, and you just think West Ham had chances. They knocked on the door. They didn't quite blow it down, though, did they?
No, I think that's right. I think, whether or not it's the still trying to get the best out of a team that is still, again, going through progression, everything with Declan Rice moving, and do they have the squad to really compete on two fronts, Premier League and Europe? It's still catching up to them. But as you say, yeah, if they're gonna move up the table, then they're gonna probably need someone better than Mikel Antonio. I'm afraid, there was always the talk about whether or not he needed a backup so that he didn't have to bear the whole load on him. Maybe it's time to start making the conversation about whether or not they need a new number nine up front and maybe move Antonio into the backup role, because I'm not saying they're in a relegation battle, but if they are going to be a competitive force on two fronts, especially a more competitive Europa League, then they're going to need to make some changes.
Well, Carl, when you mentioned earlier about the teams that are going to be 14th, 15th, etc., when you look at West Ham, in essence, have they got a free season in the Premier League this year that they could really just go all out in Europe, knowing that because the bottom three, bottom five, whatever, are so poor, that West Ham aren't going to be in a relegation battle no matter what they do?
Yeah, I think if you having looked at the early season form, I think if you were West Ham now, you probably could be sitting there thinking, listen, lads, we're not going down this season. There's easily going to be three teams worse than us. So, as long as we do what we should do in the league, we'll win enough home games to make sure that we're probably a mid-table side, just, if it's a mid-table round that area in the league. And then we can actually give the Europa League a real good go this year and see if, we've had some European glory already. Maybe we can, ride it as much as we can and go as far as we can in this competition. Because as you say, Dan, I don't see West Ham being a side that are in trouble again down this season.
Yeah, I mean, just embrace it, really. I mean, it almost gives more time. I don't know what the demand now would be. I mean, if you've got the Europa League, who knows, if they win that, they'd be in the Champions League. So you kind of think, without the trapdoor being open, you've got an absolute brilliant crack at having Champions League football next season. And as you say, Cole, as long as you just do the basics and chip in with home wins every now and again and just stop a real fear factor around the club in terms of, we're doomed. And I just feel that teams like West Ham, Palace, maybe Nottingham Forest, have got it so easy this season. But Matthew, let's quickly chat about Liverpool's midfield and the brutal, substantial change at the same time. People are calling this Liverpool 2.0 under Klopp. Has that brutal change and the quickness of it helped him evolve so quickly?
I think it has, because you look at what they, you look at what they lost. And I think that midfield was due for some change. Whether or not it was necessary to, ramped up a bit by the Saudi Arabian move. Jordan Henderson probably would have stuck around for another year and all that sort of stuff. But it was clear that midfield three needed some changes, and the players they have brought in, took him a while, but they are now starting to gel into a system that you think, right, this could be the Liverpool midfield three, four, if you want to add their rotations and everything for the next years to come.
Now, of course, Liverpool are 2 points behind Manchester City, who made it 6-6 at the weekend. But Carl, they're going to be without Rodri for the game against Arsenal in a couple of weeks due to his sending off. How costly do you reckon that will end up being?
Yeah, I think, this is one of them, isn't it, where, I messaged you after seeing this sending off and saying that, it's one of them, he gives the officials a decision to make. I don't think there's as much contact as there was to make Morgan Gibbs-White go down like he'd just been knocked out by Mike Tyson. But he was silly to give the officials the opportunity to kind of look at that and give him the red card. And it will affect Man City because he is one of their better players and, you know, probably one of the best holding midfielders in the league at the moment. But I still feel City probably just have enough about them to get through the three games that he'll be missing. And it probably won't have too big a knock-on effect to their league campaign. But what you would be saying if you was his manager is sitting there saying, listen, you can't afford you to do things like that and give officials an easy decision to make and send you off, you know, whether it was soft or not. But you just can't go around doing that because we will, you know, with De Bruyne out right now, they will need all the bodies they've got. So he was silly. I think, you know, he was unlucky in, like I say, the play acting from Morgan Gibbs-White to go down doesn't help him. And that's where players, I think, need to look at themselves in how they react to certain situations. But don't give an opportunity, especially for really, what was it, just a small shove in the back? Well, if you're 6'5" and, you know, built athlete, I'm sure you can cope with stuff like that.
Matthew, what's your take on it? Because obviously, as Cole alludes to, Morgan Gibbs-White makes a meal of it, but he's got the invite to make a meal of it. It's the position of the hands and where they are. You just can't do that now, can you?
Yeah, that's on my sort of notes. I'd say. So Rodri probably deserved a red, but, you know, he shouldn't have risked going up that high. You know, if he'd have, you know, pushed him away more towards the chest area... maybe you would have got a yellow, but the fact he's going up that high towards the neck area makes it, yeah, as Carl says, gave the referee a decision to make. And, you know, that's never going to look good in any way. As Morgan Gibbs-White did make the most of it, but if you're going around that area, then you are inviting a red card. So I don't know if there's a right of appeal in this situation, but I think it'd be very hard to overturn it if there is.
No, I think he's banged to rights on that one, isn't he, Matthew? But, Carl, if you're Man City and Pep Guardiola, obviously you're going to Arsenal in a couple of weeks. The gap is 4 points now. Let's assume it's 4 points before kickoff. Are you going for the jugular without Rodri? It could be 7 points at that stage. Or are you sort of thinking, without my key midfielder, we'll take a draw and we've still got the Etihad to worry about later in the season?
I think at the moment, I think City probably feeling confident that, you know, they'll go for it no matter who they're playing. And like, as I think Guardiola would probably think, is that, listen, the quicker we build up a massive gap and kind of demoralise our title-chasing opponents into thinking, well, they're too far ahead already, you know, the title's kind of gone, then that's what you want to do, isn't it? You know, you want to kind of kill any opponents that might be trying to come for you and ultimately go into their ground, beating them and extending the gap to something like 6-7 points already that early in the season just actually gives you the momentum and kills the momentum of the other teams and kind of deflates them. So I think City will be going and looking that they're going to go and win that game and carry on this impressive start to the season. And, you know, if they carry on doing the job that they're doing right now, they could have the title wrapped up very early this season.
Well, this is it, Matthew. I mean, let's assume that Man City do the business at the Emirates. The 7 points clear. We spoke about Liverpool being on their coattails at the moment. When you see what you've seen already, does this have all the hallmarks of a classic title race, or are we looking at one horse race territory?
It's a tough one. I think it's still too early to say, but I really hope it. I hope it doesn't turn into one horse race. I think everyone would like it to be competitive. I think I sort of said this towards the end of last season. I don't mind if Man City win it again, if they, you know, this will make it what, 4 years in a row, 5 years, or however many it is. I wouldn't mind that so long as it's competitive right until the end. Now, if it's another Centurion season where it's wrapped up by the start of April, then that's something different. But if it goes down to the last game of the season, be it from Arsenal, be it from, you know, say it quietly, but say it's from Spurs, say it's from Liverpool, it doesn't matter. So long as it's competitive, I think that's what everyone really wants.
Yeah, you're right. You made that point last season, but I think we came to the consensus that we don't really mind who wins the Premier League. Obviously, we want our teams to win the Premier League, but it's not about, you know, this length of domination in terms of like a PSG, like a Bayern Munich. As long as you get a good, honest title race, that'll do for me. I'm not really that fussed about the team at the top. What you don't want to see is City winning by 12, by 15. It's done and dusted by Easter, especially this season with probably no real relegation battle. There's a lot sort of still to play for, but you kind of think, oh, we've kind of been cheated as fans. So hopefully it's not like that, but then I don't really want to be wishing Arsenal victories either. That said, Carl, let's talk about Nottingham Forest very quickly. Is it the same method as West Ham that I don't think they can relax too much, not in the West Ham vein, but again, looking at what we've seen at the bottom, it's going to have to be a real dreadful season for them to go down.
Yeah, and I think we've actually seen enough from Frobis so far this season to actually think they'll be okay. You know, they've done well in certain games. You know, they did well to make sure it only stayed at 2-0 at the weekend, because having gone 2 down with inside the 15 minutes, that could easily on another day turn into one of those routes where it's 6 or 7 possibly the other way. So I think they kind of did well, and we've seen enough from them in other games to suggest I think they'll win enough home games this season to make sure that they're well above those bottom three. And like as you say, Dan, you're looking right now thinking, can we be worse than those three teams? I very much doubt it. So I think Forest will be fine. I think they probably finish around sort of 13th, 14th maybe.
Yes, I think that's a fair shout there. Matthew, as for Forest, there's been a lot of talk about Harry Arter in the last few days. The fact he won't cancel his 40 grand a week contract, even though he hasn't played for the club in 2 years. Now, we spoke about Harry Maguire sitting on the bench and we sort of said, is it a lack of desire? Is it his rights? If you're Harry Arter, you haven't played for 2 years. Again, is this a lack of desire, or are you just rightly taking the club to the cleaners?
My first thought when I first heard this story was it's Winston Bogard all over again, for those of you who before the money came around to Chelsea. I think there is an element. Yeah, it's his right. They signed the contract. You know, they said he was worth X amount of money a week. The fact that they don't think he's worth X amount of money a week, that's not on Harry Arter's fault. And you know, he's not necessarily someone who has an international career that he needs to be fighting for or whatever. If he's happy just taking 40 grand a week and just sitting there and not playing, if he's fine with that, then by all means, you know, he didn't blackmail them into the situation. He didn't force his way through anything. If that's the situation, then by all means, go for it.
Yeah, fair play. Exactly. You know, more power to him. If that's the contract and he stipulated to collect 40 grand a week, you can't blame the player, can you? That's where we're at. So although it's kind of easy to sort of say, well, just go and play anywhere, go and play on loan, you know, walk away. Why would you if someone's offering you 40 a week? If I was offering Carl and Matthew 40 grand a week to not do this podcast, you would not take it, would you, chap? Anyway,
I wouldn't take the money, then. It wouldn't make me happy.
that's the right answer. Right, let's go to Wolves next. And they're going to be looking to exercise their right to complain to the PGMOL after a 1-1 draw at Luton. Cole, what do you make of the penalty award, which has finally seen the Hatters get off the mark for the campaign?
Yeah, well, I think they've got a strong case for getting one of these apologies, haven't they, Dan? You know, especially when you consider the ruling, that the ruling says, you know, if it hits another part of the body first and then onto the hand, then I don't see how the mistake has been made in this penalty being given this weekend. You know, this is one of those ludicrous ones. And again, you're sitting there saying, even if they get the apology, what good does that do Wolves at the end of the day? Because ultimately the apology can't bring back the 3 points. And that's what Wolves will be saying. Listen, the season we're going to have, that could have been an important and would be an important 3 points for us. We haven't got that now. And it's because of a blatant bad officiating on all sides. So this is the sort of stuff that really needs to be sorted out, because this was a dreadful decision.
Well, Matthew, my understanding, same as Carl's, is that if you're handling after a deflection from your sort of previous body part, that can't be a penalty in the same instance. So, you know, with that understanding of the law, how has the referee come to a different conclusion? And more importantly, if the PGMOL do hand this apology, are they quickly becoming not worth the paper they're printed on?
To answer the second bit, yeah, I think there is that point of, you know, what good are they doing if this is all they can do after, you know, after the fact? I mean, we're not saying that, you know, club should have a point retrospectively taken away or add 2 points or a game added 2 points or whatever. We're not saying that, but the fact there is that, you know, apology isn't gonna do much towards the end of the season. You know, if it ends up costing a European place or a relegation spot or anything like that. But back to the first point, I think it just comes down to, again, the overarching thing of inconsistency of, you know, one referee may have given the penalty that another referee might not have, and just there needs to be more concrete, you know, laws laid down to say this is what happens in these situations.
Of course, Carl, Wolves went down to 10 men. They obviously went ahead, actually, through Pedro Neto. But let's focus on the red card, because you've seen worse, but it was kind of a weird tangle and then a, you know, an action afterwards. So in your book, are you sending off the player whose name I can't remember or not even going to try and pronounce? So what would you be doing there?
Yeah, I think it is, because again, you know, again, you could question how much has he hurt the player that he's done it to. You know, I don't think from what we've seen, there's enough to make the player sort of roll around on the floor the way he does. But like with the previous discussion we were having around the red card, if you do that stamping motion, you're giving the officials a decision to make. And ultimately, I think you made it too easy for them to say, well, look, he does kick out there. So that is a red card. So I don't, you know, he was stupid again. It's like, just don't give officials these opportunities. And, you know, you're costing your side. So I think the red card was warranted there as well.
Matthew, in terms of Wolves, are they going to be disappointed not to walk away from Kenilworth Road with all 3 points? I mean, on paper, they've got the quality. Obviously, Luton have not had a sniff before that game. And obviously, the penalty then leads to them getting into the game and getting the points. So, if you're looking at the fixture computer and Wolves there, are they sort of going to kick themselves to not get three?
I think any team that, you know, given the start that Luton have had, unless this startup, you know, kickstarts a vein of form that all of a sudden Luton are world beaters, I highly doubt it. But again, going into the game, you'd think, right, this should be, you know, hopefully be an easy 3 points for any side, given how Luton have performed so far this season. So I think, yeah, they would definitely be very frustrated not to pick up a win.
Well, Luton are off the mark, but unfortunately for them, Everton found their first win of the season. Cole, on the evidence of Everton's win, and going back to what we've seen from the promoted sides, the Toffees can't breathe easily all of a sudden, but there might just be a chink of light in this very dark tunnel on Goodison.
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, we have to give them credit because I think, you know, they really deserved that win at the weekend. You know, they really played well. I think it's probably the best they've played all season, and to be honest, that's not an easy place to go, Brentford, and get a result. So that could be a result that kind of kickstarts Everton's season a little bit, especially with Calvert-Lewin scoring as well. So it's like, as we've said before, Dan, I think ultimately Everton now can look down and just go, there'll be three teams worse than us this season, no matter what. And again, if we can now take this momentum and start getting some results at home as well, we'll be okay. We will be safe. And they couldn't have the perfect opportunity because they've got Luton at home next. So that is a really important game because they don't want to play really well away at Brentford and then go and come unstuck against Luton at home because that just derails everything. This is a great opportunity to get two back-to-back wins. And then who knows where their season might take them.
Matthew, is the narrative changing around Hounslow Town suddenly in the fact that they've only won once this season? Again, they're in that kind of mid-table no man's land, if you will. So anything to worry about there? I think my concern is the goalkeeper more than anything else. He looks really erratic post David Raya and he's moved to Arsenal. So I know you're not going to be worried personally as a Fulham supporter, but if you were a Brentford fan or Hounslow Town, as we should say, in your when you're around us, what would you be worrying about?
Honestly, I think it would be, the main concern is just how much they have been affected by the loss of Ivan Toney. And no, again, I never said they were going to be a relegation, you know, threat without him. But the fact is, it's clearly just gotten shown just how important he was to the team. Because again, a couple of the chances that Brentford had, he probably would have stuck away. So yeah, the goalkeeper's an issue, but you know, goal scoring at the other end probably solves a lot of problems. So it sounds simple, but I think it is that simple that they are just missing Ivan Toney. They've just got to tread water until he comes back in January or February time, whenever it is.
Now, Carl, Brighton returned to winning ways after a midweek Europa League defeat. They lost 3-2 at home to AEK Athens. A bit of a surprise, in my opinion. Was there a bit of naivety, obviously, on the European stage for the first time? I guess the baptism of fire to a certain degree. What did you make of that performance?
Yeah, it was a strange one, wasn't it, seeing them lose that game in the week? Because when you looked on paper, you just thought, well, they'll win that game. You know, they'll kick off their European campaign in a good manner. And it was a surprising defeat. But I guess they can come in Europe because you can get overawed with the whole, you know, what's going on and our first game in Europe for so long. And sometimes it can turn out to be a bit of a flat one. But they bounce back really well. And they are a good team. And I think they'll be okay in Europe. They'll sort that out and they'll get themselves through. And then it will see how far they can go there. this will just be the case of how much does European football take out of that squad this season, and will that have a knock-on effect? But they did the job perfectly this weekend to answer, you know, to come back and get that shock defeat out of their system.
Yeah, they certainly did. I guess, Matthew, the real kind of concern would be from a Bournemouth point of view, because they haven't won this season. They've got a new manager in Andoni Areola. So you're kind of looking at that and thinking, is he the right man for the job? Has he got the right players? Has he got the time to sort of bed in his ideas? If there's going to be one team that looks like it's going to be dragged into that mess, it might be Bournemouth now. So if you're a Cherry supporter, what's your concerns after 6 weeks?
I wouldn't be too concerned. There is, as you said, that element of, you know, new manager coming in and trying to embed his this and everything. And I think there is still that cushion of how just how badly the bottom, you know, the three promoted teams have done. So that probably gives them a little bit of a cushion. If they continue to perform badly, then Bournemouth probably see themselves as, right, we could probably get away with a, you know, a couple of bad results, give him the time, as it were. So I wouldn't be too concerned just yet, but if they're in this same position this time next month, then there might still be some need for some concerns.
Now, Carl, what about Burnley? Because they lost again at the weekend to Manchester United. That's a fourth home defeat out of five, the way the fixture computer has landed. There were a lot of home fixtures thus far. So we spoke about Ange Postecoglou earlier and the fact that he looked at how Spurs were playing and didn't change his ideals. He stuck with them, got a relative reward. With Vincent Kompany, you're looking at these performances as a whole and thinking it's not quite working. And now Burnley, in my opinion, have just become another Premier League team. They've lost that, the nastiness. Turf Moor is a nice place to go to all of a sudden, but because of that, Burnley aren't going to be the Burnley of old, and they're just kind of in the Premier League and not really doing what they would do best. So if you're Vincent Kompany, at what point do you start changing things?
Yeah, I'm not sure they will, Dan, though, because again, I think he's got a method of how he wants to play. And you know what? I do think he's probably been told, look, this year you've got freedom to actually play this way and carry on doing what you're doing, because we see a longer term future with you at the helm. You know, yes, we didn't think we probably had the quality to kind of compete in the Premier League, and we knew we were going to be in a relegation battle. So I don't think he's going to change the way that he wants to play. But I think, like as you said, the fact that they've had quite a lot of home games and not managed to get the points on the board, which is where you would think, well, that's where your survival hopes really, you know, are pinning on your home form. So I do think that is a worry for them. But I just don't see him changing. I think he's got a philosophy and that's how he's going to play. And he's probably been given the freedom to do that by the board, saying, well, if we go down, we go down and we'll come back up again and try and build. So I don't think he'll change. But as you say, I think that's going to cost them this season massively.
And Matthew, finally, we have got time to talk about the pod derby. Hello, Max, between Palace and Fulham. A ball draw. So in your opinion, are you happy with a point on the road or disappointed with the chances you made to not get all three?
Yeah, happy with the draw. Obviously, still some. It's going to sound like a broken record, but still some growing pains trying to work out how to recover from losing Mitrovic. Raul probably had his best chance to get off the score, to get off the mark, as it were, but scuffed his chance. I think the goals will come, and I think that someone's pointing out we've sort of establish ourselves as a very good defensive team. Clean sheets are easy to come. No, we can deal with that. It's just sorting out the goals, and I think they're going to come soon enough. So I'm not in any concerning position right now.
Good shout. Right, we've hit full time. So I just need to do the admin before we wrap up, and that's thanking my two excellent Pod Squad members. Matthew, thanks for your time this afternoon and also waking up very early on that side of the States. I hope you enjoyed that one.
Yeah, pleasure as always.
And Carl, thanks for wearing the captain's armband. I hope you'll join me next time.
Yeah, definitely, Dan. Looking forward to it.
Absolutely. Right, cheers, guys, and also to the listeners out there. And with that said, it just leaves me to say that my name's Dan Tracy. This is The Real Football Cast. And until next time, goodbye.
Podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Sports Social Podcast Network.